Disc 2.
The discoverer and the inventor are the bane of business. A little sand in the works is comparatively a mere nothing. You just replace the damaged parts and go on. But the appearance of a new process, a new substance when you are all organized and ticking nicely, is the very devil. Sometimes it is worse than that. It just cannot be allowed to occur. Too much is at stake. If you can't use legal methods, you must try others. For Umberto had understated the case. It was not simply that the competition of a cheap new oil would send Arctic and European and their associates out of business. The effects would be widespread. It might not be fatal to the groundnut, the olive, the whale, and a number of other oil industries, but it would be a nasty knock. Moreover, there would be violent repercussions in dependent industries, in margarine, soap, and 100 more products from face creams to house paints and beyond. Indeed, once a few of the more influential concerns had grasped the quality of the menace, Umberto's terms came to seem almost modest. He got his agreement, for his samples were convincing if the rest was somewhat vague. In point of fact, it cost those interested quite a lot less than they had undertaken to pay, for after Umberto went off with his aeroplane and his advance, he was never seen again. But that is not to say he was altogether unheard of. Some years later, an indeterminate individual giving simply the name Fedor turned up at the offices of Arctic and European Oils. They had dropped fish from both their title and activities then. He was, he said, a Russian. He would like, he said, some money, if the kind capitalists would be good enough to spare some. His story was that he had been employed in the first experimental Trifid station in the district of Elovsk, in Kamchatka. It was a forlorn place, and he greatly disliked it. His desire to get away had caused him to listen to a suggestion from another worker there, to be specific, on Tovarich Nikolai Alexandrovich Baltinov, and the suggestion had been backed up by several thousand rubles. It did not require a great deal of earning. He had simply to remove a box of sorted fertile Trifid seeds from its rack and substitute a similar box of infertile seeds. The purloined box was to be left at a certain place at a certain time. There was practically no risk. It might be years before the substitution was discovered. A further requirement, however, was a little more tricky. He was to see that a pattern of lights was laid out on a large field a mile or two from the plantation. He was to be there himself on a certain night. He would hear an aeroplane flying directly above. He would switch on the lights. The plane would land. The best thing he could do then would be to get away from the neighborhood as soon as possible before anyone should arrive to investigate. For these services, he would receive not only the comfortable wad of rubles, but if he should succeed in leaving Russia, he would find more money waiting for him at the offices of Arctic and European in England. By his account, the operation had gone entirely to plan. Fedor had not waited once the plane was down. He had switched off the lights and beat it. The plane had stopped only a short time, perhaps not 10 minutes, before it took off again. From the sound of the jets, he judged that it was climbing steeply as it went. A minute or so after the noise had died away, he heard the sound of engines again. Some more planes went over, headed east, after the other. There might have been two or more, he could not tell. But they were travelling very fast, with their jets shrieking. The next day, Comrade Baltinov was missing. There had been a lot of trouble, but in the end it was decided that Baltinov must have been working alone. So it had all passed off safely for Fedor. He had cautiously waited for a year before he made a move. It had cost him almost the last of his rubles by the time he had bought his way through the final obstacles. Then he had had to take various jobs to live, so that he had spent a long time in reaching England. But now he had. Could he have some money, please? Something had been heard about Elovsk by that time, and the date he gave for the plane landing was within probability. So they gave him some money. They also gave him a job and told him to keep his mouth shut. For it was clear that though Umberto had not personally delivered the goods, he had at least saved the situation by broadcasting them. Arctic European had not at first connected the appearance of the Triffids with Umberto, and the police of several countries went on keeping an eye open for him on their behalf. It was not until some investigator produced a specimen of Triffid oil for their inspection that they realized that it corresponded exactly with the sample Umberto had showed them, and that it was the seeds of the Triffid he had set out to bring. What happened to Umberto himself will never be definitely known. It is my guess that over the Pacific Ocean, somewhere high up in the stratosphere, he and Comrade Baltinov found themselves attacked by the planes that Fedor had heard in pursuit. It may be that the first they knew of it was when cannon shells from Russian fighters started to break up their craft. And I think, too, that one of those shells blew to pieces a certain 12-inch cube of plywood, the receptacle like a small tea-chest in which, according to Fedor, the seeds were packed. Perhaps Umberto's plane exploded, perhaps it just fell to pieces. Whichever it was, I am sure that when the fragments began their long, long fall towards the sea, they left behind them something which looked at first like a white vapor. It was not vapor. It was a cloud of seeds, floating so infinitely light they were, even in the rarefied air. Millions of gossamer-slung Triffid seeds, free now to drift wherever the winds of the world should take them. It might be weeks, perhaps months, before they would sink to earth at last, many of them thousands of miles from their starting place. That is, I repeat, conjecture. But I cannot see a more probable way in which that plant, intended to be kept secret, could come, quite suddenly, to be found in almost every part of the world. My introduction to a Triffid came early. It so happened that we had one of the first in the locality growing in our own garden. The plant was quite well developed before any of us bothered to notice it, for it had taken root along with a number of other casuals behind the bit of hedge that screened the rubbish heap. It wasn't doing any harm there, and it wasn't in anyone's way. So when we did notice it later on, we'd just take a look at it now and then to see how it was getting along, and let it be. However, a Triffid is certainly distinctive, and we couldn't help getting a bit curious about it, after a time. Not perhaps very actively, for there are always a few unfamiliar things that somehow or other manage to lodge in the neglected corners of a garden, but enough to mention to one another that it was beginning to look a pretty queer sort of thing. Nowadays, when everyone knows only too well what a Triffid looks like, it is difficult to recall how odd and somehow foreign the first ones appeared to us. Nobody, as far as I know, felt any misgiving or alarm about them then. I imagine that most people thought of them, when they thought of them at all, in much the same way that my father did. I have a picture in my memory of him examining ours and puzzling over it at a time when it must have been about a year old. In almost every detail it was a half-size replica of a fully grown Triffid, only it didn't have a name yet, and no one had seen one fully grown. My father leant over, peering at it through his horn-rimmed glasses, fingering its stalk, and blowing gently through his gingery moustache, as was his habit when thoughtful. He inspected the straight stem and the woody bowl from which it sprang. He gave curious, if not very penetrative, attention to the three small bare sticks which grew straight up beside the stem. He smoothed the short sprays of leathery green leaves between his finger and thumb as if their texture might tell him something. Then he peered into the curious funnel-like formation at the top of the stem, still puffing reflectively, but inconclusively, through his moustache. I remember the first time he lifted me up to look inside that conical cup and see the tightly wrapped wall within. It looked not unlike the new, close-rolled frond of a fern, emerging a couple of inches from a sticky mess in the base of the cup. I did not touch it, but I knew the stuff must be sticky because there were flies and other small insects struggling in it. More than once my father ruminated that it was pretty queer, and observed that one of these days he really must try and find out what it was. I don't think he ever made the effort, nor at that stage was he likely to have learned much if he had tried. The thing would be about 4 feet high, then. There must have been plenty of them about, growing up quietly and inoffensively with nobody taking any particular notice of them. At least it seemed so, for if the biological or botanical experts were excited over them, no news of their interest percolated to the general public. And so the one in our garden continued its growth peacefully, as did thousands like it, in neglected spots all over the world. It was some little time later that the first one picked up its roots and walked. That improbable achievement must, of course, have been known for some time in Russia, where it was doubtless classified as a state secret. But as far as I have been able to confirm, its first occurrence in the outside world took place in Indochina, which meant that people went on taking practically no notice. Indochina was one of those regions from which such curious and unlikely yarns might be expected to drift in, and frequently did. The kind of thing an editor might conceivably use if news were scarce and a touch of the mysterious East would liven the paper up a bit. But in any case, the Indo-Chinese specimen can have had no great lead. Within a few weeks, reports of walking plants were pouring in from Sumatra, Borneo, the Belgian Congo, Colombia, Brazil, and most places in the neighborhood of the equator. This time they got into print all right. But the much-handled stories, written up with that blend of cautiously defensive frivolity which the press habitually employed to cover themselves in matters regarding sea serpents, elementals, thought transference, and other irregular phenomena, prevented anyone from realizing that these accomplished plants at all resembled the quiet, respectable weed beside our rubbish heap. Not until the pictures began to appear did we realize that they were identical with it, save in size. The newsreel men were quickly off the mark. Possibly they got some good and interesting pictures for their trouble of flying to outlandish places. But there was a current theory among cutters that more than a few seconds of any one news subject, except a boxing match, could not fail to paralyze an audience with boredom. My first view, therefore, of a development which was to play such an important part in my future, as well as in so many other people's, was a glimpse sandwiched between a hula contest in Honolulu and the First Lady launching a battleship. But that is no anachronism. They were still building them. Even admirals had to live. I was permitted to see a few triffids sway across the screen, to the kind of accompaniment supposed to be on the level of the great movie-going public.
"And now, folks, get a load of what our cameraman found in Ecuador. Vegetables on vacation. You've only seen this kind of thing after a party, but down in sunny Ecuador they see it any time, and no hangover to follow. Monster plants on the march. Say, that's given me a big idea. Maybe if we can educate our potatoes right, we can fix it so they'll walk right into the pot. How'd that be, Mama?"
For the short time the scene was on, I stared at it fascinated. There was our mysterious rubbish heap plant grown to a height of 7 feet or more. There was no mistaking it. And it was walking. The bowl, which I now saw for the first time, was shaggy with little rootlet hairs. It would have been almost spherical but for three bluntly tapered projections extending from the lower part. Supported on these, the main body was lifted about a foot clear of the ground. When it walked, it moved rather like a man on crutches. Two of the blunt legs slid forward, then the whole thing lurched as the rear one drew almost level with them, then the two in front slid forward again. At each step, the long stem whipped violently back and forth. It gave one a kind of seasick feeling to watch it. As a method of progress, it looked both strenuous and clumsy, faintly reminiscent of young elephants at play. One felt that if it were to go on lurching for long in that fashion, it would be bound to strip all its leaves if it did not actually break its stem. Nevertheless, ungainly though it looked, it was contriving to cover the ground at something like an average walking pace. That was about all I had time to see before the battleship launching began. It was not a lot, but it was enough to incite an investigating spirit in a boy. For if that thing in Ecuador could do a trick like that, why not the one in our garden? Admittedly, ours was a good deal smaller, but it did look the same. About 10 minutes after I got home, I was digging round our triffid, carefully loosening the earth near it to encourage it to walk. Unfortunately, there was an aspect of this self-propelled plant discovery which the newsreel people had either not experienced or had chosen for some reason of their own not to reveal. There was no warning, either. I was bending down, intent on clearing the earth without harming the plant, when something from nowhere hit me one terrific slam and knocked me out. I woke up to find myself in bed, with my mother, my father, and the doctor watching me anxiously. My head felt as if it were split open. I was aching all over, and as I later discovered, one side of my face was decorated with a blotchy red raised wheal. The insistent questions as to how I came to be lying unconscious in the garden were quite useless. I had no faintest idea what it was that had hit me. And some little time passed before I learned that I must have been one of the first persons in England to be stung by a triffid and get away with it. The triffid was, of course, immature. But before I had fully recovered, my father had found out what had undoubtedly happened to me, and by the time I went into the garden again, he had wreaked stern vengeance on our triffid and disposed of the remains on a bonfire. Now that walking plants were established facts, the press lost its former tepidity and bathed them in publicity. So a name had to be found for them. Already there were botanists wallowing after their custom in polysyllabic dog Latin and Greek to produce variants on ambulans and pseudopodia. But what the newspapers and the public wanted was something easy on the tongue and not too heavy on the headlines for general use. If you could see the papers of that time, you would find them referring to tricots, tricusps, trigonates, trigons, trilogs, tridentates, trinets, tripedals, tripeds, trichets, tripods, trippets, and a number of other mysterious things not even beginning with tri, though almost all centred on the feature of that active three-pronged root. There was argument, public, private, and bar parlour, with heated championship of one term or another on near-scientific, quasi-etymological, and a number of other grounds. But gradually one term began to dominate this philological gymkhana. In its first form it was not quite acceptable, but common usage modified the original long first I, and custom quickly wrote in a second F, to leave no doubt about it. And so emerged the standard term. A catchy little name originating in some newspaper office as a handy label for an oddity, but destined one day to be associated with pain, fear, and misery. Triffid. The first wave of public interest soon ebbed away. Triffids were admittedly a bit weird, but that was, after all, just because they were novelties. People had felt the same about novelties of other days, about kangaroos, giant lizards, black swans. And when you came to think of it, were triffids all that much queerer than mudfish, ostriches, tadpoles, and 100 other things? The bat was an animal that had learned to fly. Well, here was a plant that had learned to walk. What of that? But there were features of it to be less casually dismissed. On its origins, the Russians, true to type, lay low and said nothing. Even those who had heard of Umberto did not yet connect him with it. Its sudden appearance, and even more its wide distribution, prompted very puzzled speculation. For though it matured more rapidly in the tropics, specimens in various stages of development were reported from almost any region outside the polar circles and the deserts. People were surprised, and a little disgusted, to learn that the species was carnivorous, and that the flies and other insects caught in the cups were actually digested by the sticky substance there. We in temperate zones were not ignorant of insectivorous plants, but we were unaccustomed to find them outside special hothouses, and apt to consider them as in some way slightly indecent, or at least improper. But actually alarming was the discovery that the wall topping a triffid stem could lash out as a slender stinging weapon 10 feet long, capable of discharging enough poison to kill a man if it struck squarely on his unprotected skin. As soon as this danger was appreciated, there followed a nervous smashing and chopping of triffids everywhere, until it occurred to someone that all that was necessary to make them harmless was the removal of the actual stinging weapon. At this, the slightly hysterical assault upon the plants declined, with their numbers considerably thinned. A little later, it began to be a fashion to have a safely docked triffid or two about one's garden. It was found that it took about 2 years for the lost sting to be dangerously replaced, so that an annual pruning assured that they were in a state of safety where they could provide vast amusement for the children. In temperate countries, where man had succeeded in putting most forms of nature, save his own, under a reasonable degree of restraint, the status of the triffid was thus made quite clear. But in the tropics, particularly in the dense forest areas, they quickly became a scourge. The traveller very easily failed to notice one among the normal bushes and undergrowth, and the moment he was in range the venomous sting would slash out. Even the regular inhabitant of such a district found it difficult to detect a motionless triffid cunningly lurking beside a jungle path. They were uncannily sensitive to any movement near them, and it was hard to take them unawares. Dealing with them became a serious problem in such regions. The most favoured method was to shoot the top off the stem and the sting with it. The jungle natives took to carrying long, light poles mounted with hooked knives, which they used effectively if they could get their blows in first. But not at all, if the triffid had a chance to sway forward and increase its range by an unexpected 4 or 5 feet. Before long, however, these pike-like devices were mostly superseded by spring-operated guns of various types. Most of them shot spinning discs, crosses, or small boomerangs of thin steel. As a rule, they were inaccurate above about 12 yards, though capable of slicing a triffid stem neatly at 25 if they hit it. Their invention pleased both the authorities, who had an almost unanimous distaste for the indiscriminate toting of rifles, and the users, who found the missiles of razor blade steel far cheaper and lighter than cartridges, and admirably adaptable to silent banditry. Elsewhere, immense research into the nature, habits, and constitution of the triffid went on. Earnest experimenters set out to determine in the interests of science how far and for how long it could walk, whether it could be said to have a front, or could perform its march in any direction with equal clumsiness, what proportion of its time it must spend with its roots in the ground, what reactions it showed to the presence of various chemicals in the soil, and a vast quantity of other questions, both useful and useless. The largest specimen ever observed in the tropics stood nearly 10 feet high. No European specimen over 8 feet had been seen, and the average was a little over 7. They appeared to adapt easily to a wide range of climate and soils. They had, it seemed, no natural enemies, other than man. But there were a number of not unobvious characteristics which escaped comment for some little time. It was, for instance, quite a while before anyone drew attention to the uncanny accuracy with which they aimed their stings, and that they almost invariably struck for the head. Nor did anyone at first take notice of their habit of lurking near their fallen victims. The reason for that only became clear when it was shown that they fed upon flesh, as well as upon insects. The stinging tendril did not have the muscular power to tear firm flesh, but it had strength enough to pull shreds from a decomposing body and lift them to the cup on its stem. There was no great interest either in the three little leafless sticks at the base of the stem. There was a light notion that they might have something to do with the reproductive system, that system which tends to be a sort of botanical glory hole for all parts of doubtful purpose until they can be sorted out and more specifically assigned later on. It was assumed, consequently, that their characteristic of suddenly losing their immobility and rattling a rapid tattoo against the main stem was some strange form of triffidian amatory exuberance. Possibly my uncomfortable distinction of getting myself stung so early in the triffid era had the effect of stimulating my interest, for I seemed to have a sort of link with them from then on. I spent, or wasted, if you look at me through my father's eyes, a great deal of fascinated time watching them. One could not blame him for considering this a worthless pursuit, yet later the time turned out to have been better employed than either of us suspected, for it was just before I left school that the Arctic and European Fish Oil Company reconstituted itself, dropping the word fish in the process. The public learned that it and similar companies in other countries were about to farm triffids on a large scale in order to extract valuable oils and juices, and to press highly nutritious oil cake for stock feeding. Consequently, triffids moved into the realm of big business overnight. Right away, I decided my future. I applied to the Arctic and European, where my qualifications got me a job in the production side. My father's disapproval was somewhat qualified by the rate of pay, which was good for my age. But when I spoke enthusiastically of the future, he blew doubtfully through his moustache. He had real faith only in a type of work steadied by long tradition, but he let me have my way. "After all, if the thing isn't a success, you'll find out young enough to start in on something more solid," he conceded. There turned out to be no need for that. Before he and my mother were killed together in a holiday Airbus crash 5 years later, They had seen the new companies drive all competing oils off the market, and those of us who had been in at the beginning, apparently well set for life. One of the early comers was my friend Walter Luckner. There had been some doubt at first about taking Walter on. He knew little of agriculture, less of business, and lacked the qualifications for lab work. On the other hand, he did know a lot about triffids. He had a kind of inspired knack with them. What happened to Walter that fatal May years later, I do not know, though I can guess. It is a sad thing that he did not escape. He might have been immensely valuable later on. I don't think anybody really understands triffids, or ever will, but Walter came nearer to beginning to understand them than any man I have ever known. Or should I say that he was given to intuitive feelings about them? It was a year or two after the job had begun that he first surprised me. The sun was close to setting. We had knocked off for the day and were looking with a sense of satisfaction at three new fields of nearly fully grown triffids. In those days we didn't simply corral them as we did later. They were arranged across the fields roughly in rows. At least the steel stakes to which each was tethered by a chain were in rows, though the plants themselves had no sense of tidy regimentation. We reckoned that in another month or so we'd be able to start tapping them for juice. The evening was peaceful. Almost the only sounds that broke it were the occasional rattling of the triffids' little sticks against their stems. Walter regarded them with his head slightly on one side. He removed his pipe. "Tonight," he observed. I took that as anyone else would, metaphorically. "Maybe it's the weather," I suggested. "I fancy they do it more when it's dry." He looked sidelong at me with a smile. "Do you talk more when it's dry?" "Why should—" I began, and then broke off. "You don't really mean you think they're talking," I said, noticing his expression. "Well, why not?" "But it's absurd, plants talking." "So much more absurd than plants walking?" he asked. I stared at them, and then back at him. "I never thought—" I began doubtfully. "You try thinking of it a bit and watching them. I'd be interested to hear your conclusions," he said. It was a curious thing that in all my dealings with triffids such a possibility had never occurred to me. I'd been prejudiced, I suppose, by the love core theory. But once he had put the idea into my mind, it stuck. I couldn't get away from the fact that they might indeed be rattling out secret messages to one another. Up to then I'd fancied I'd watched triffids pretty closely. But when Walter was talking about them, I felt that I'd noticed practically nothing. He could, when he was in the mood, talk on about them for hours, advancing theories that were sometimes wild, but sometimes not impossible. The public had by this time grown out of thinking triffids freakish. They were clumsily amusing, but not greatly interesting. The company found them interesting, however. It took the view that their existence was a piece of benevolence for everyone, particularly for itself. Walter shared neither view. At times, listening to him, I began to have some misgivings myself. He had become quite certain that they talked. "And that," he argued, "means that somewhere in them is intelligence. It can't be seated in a brain, because dissection shows nothing like a brain, but that doesn't prove there isn't something there that does a brain's job. And there's certainly intelligence there of a kind. Have you noticed that when they attack they always go for the unprotected parts? Almost always the head, but sometimes the hands? And another thing, if you look at the statistics of casualties, just take notice of the proportion that has been stung across the eyes and blinded. It's remarkable. And significant." "Of what?" I asked. "Of the fact that they know what is the surest way to put a man out of action. In other words, they know what they're doing. Look at it this way. Granted that they do have intelligence, then that would leave us with only one important superiority. Sight. We can see and they can't. Take away our vision, and the superiority is gone. Worse than that, our position becomes inferior to theirs because they are adapted to a sightless existence and we are not. But even if that were so, they can't do things, they can't handle things. There's very little muscular strength in that stinglash, I pointed out.
Well, true.
But what's the good of our ability to handle things if we can't see what to do with them? Anyway, they don't need to handle things, not in the way we do. They can get their nourishment direct from the soil or from insects and bits of raw meat. They don't have to go through all the complicated business of growing things, distributing, and they're usually cooking them as well. In fact, if it were a choice for survival between a triffid and a blind man, I know which I'd put my money on. You're assuming equal intelligence, I said.
Not at all. I don't need to. I should imagine it's likely to be an altogether different type of intelligence, if only because their needs are so much simpler. Look at the complex processes we have to use to get an assimilable extract from a triffid. Now, reverse that. What does the triffid have to do? Just sting us, wait a few days, and then begin to assimilate us. The simple, natural course of things.
He would go on like that by the hour, until listening to him would have me getting things out of proportion, and I'd find myself thinking of the triffids as though they were some kind of competitor. Walter himself never pretended to think otherwise. He admitted, thought of writing a book on that very aspect of the subject when he had gathered more material. Had, I repeated. What's stopping you?
Just this. He waved his hand to include the farm generally. It's a vested interest now. It wouldn't pay anyone to put out disturbing thoughts about it. Anyway, we have the triffids controlled well enough, so it's an academic point and scarcely worth raising.
I never can be quite sure with you, I told him. I'm never certain how far you're serious and how far beyond your facts you allow your imagination to lead you. Do you honestly think there is a danger in the things? He puffed a bit at his pipe before he answered.
That's fair enough, he admitted, because, well, I'm by no means sure myself, but I'm pretty certain of one thing, and that is that there could be danger in them. I'd feel a lot nearer giving you a real answer if I could get a line on what it means when they patter. Somehow, I don't care for that. There they sit, with everyone thinking no more of them than they might be a pretty odd lot of cabbages.
Yet half the time they're pattering and clattering away at one another. Why? What is it they patter about? That's what I want to know. I think Walter rarely gave a hint of his ideas to anyone else, and I kept them confidential, partly because I knew no one who wouldn't be more sceptical than I was myself, and partly because it wouldn't do either of us any good to get a reputation in the firm as crackpots. For a year or so more, we were working fairly close together. But with the opening of new nurseries and the need for studying methods abroad, I began to travel a lot. He gave up fieldwork and went into the research department. It suited him there, doing his own research as well as the company's. I used to drop in to see him from time to time. He was forever making experiments with his triffids, but the results weren't clearing his general ideas as much as he had hoped. He had proved, to his own satisfaction at least, the existence of a well-developed intelligence. And even I had to admit that his results seemed to show something more than instinct. He was still convinced that the pattering of the sticks was a form of communication. For public consumption, he had shown that the sticks were something more, and that a triffid deprived of them gradually deteriorated. He had also established that the infertility rate of triffid seeds was something like 95%.
Which, he remarked, is a damn good thing. If they all germinated, there'd soon be standing room only for triffids only on this planet.
With that, too, I agreed. Triffid seed time was quite a sight. The dark green pod just below the cup was glistening and distended, about half as big again as a large apple. When it burst, it did it with a pop that was audible 20 yards away. The white seeds shot into the air like steam and began drifting away on the lightest of breezes. Looking down on a field of triffids late in August, you could well get the idea that some kind of desultory bombardment was in progress. It was Walter's discovery again that the quality of the extracts was improved if the plants retained their stings. In consequence, the practice of docking was discontinued on farms throughout the trade, and we had to wear protective devices when working among the plants. At the time of the accident that had landed me in hospital, I was actually with Walter. We were examining some specimens which were showing unusual deviations. Both of us were wearing wire mesh masks. I did not see exactly what happened. All I know is that as I bent forward, a sting slashed viciously at my face and smacked against the wire of the mask. 99 times in 100 it would not have mattered. That was what the masks were for. but this one came with such force that some of the little poison sacs were burst open, and a few drops from them went into my eyes. Walter got me back into his lab and administered the antidote in a few seconds. It was entirely due to his quick work that they had the chance of saving my sight at all. But even so, it had meant over a week in bed, in the dark. While I lay there, I had quite decided that when, and if, I had my sight back, I was going to apply for a transfer to another side of the business. And if that did not go through, I'd quit the job altogether. I had built up a considerable resistance to Triffid poison since my first sting in the garden. I could take, and had taken, without very much harm, stings which would have laid an inexperienced man out very cold indeed. But an old saying about a pitcher and a well kept on recurring to me. I was taking my warning. I spent, I remember, a good many of my enforcedly dark hours deciding what kind of job I would try for if they would not give me that transfer. Considering what was just around the corner for us all, I could scarcely have found a contemplation more idle. Chapter 3. The Groping City. I left the pub door swinging behind me as I made my way to the corner of the main road. There I hesitated. To the left, through miles of suburban streets, lay the open country. To the right, the West End of London, with the city beyond. I was feeling somewhat restored, but curiously detached now, and rudderless. I had no glimmering of a plan, and in the face of what I had at last begun to perceive as a vast, and not merely local, catastrophe, I was still too stunned to begin to reason one out. What plan could there be to deal with such a thing? I felt forlorn, cast into desolation, and yet not quite real, not quite myself, here and now. In no direction was there any traffic nor any sound of it. The only signs of life were a few people here and there cautiously groping their ways along the shop fronts. The day was perfect for early summer. The sun poured down from a deep blue sky set with tufts of white woolly clouds. All of it was clean and fresh, save for a smear made by a single column of greasy smoke coming from somewhere behind the houses to the north. I stood there indecisively for a few minutes. Then I turned east, Londonwards. To this day I cannot quite say why. Perhaps it was an instinct to seek familiar places, or the feeling that if there were authority anywhere it must be somewhere in that direction. The brandy had made me more hungry than ever, but I did not find the problem of feeding as easy to deal with as it should have been. And yet, there were the shops, untenanted and unguarded, with food in the windows. And here was I, with hunger, and the means to pay, or if I did not wish to pay, I had only to smash a window and take what I wanted. Nevertheless, it was hard to persuade oneself to do that. I was not yet ready to admit, after nearly 30 years of a reasonably right-respecting existence and law-abiding life, that things had changed in any fundamental way. There was, too, a feeling that as long as I remained my normal self, things might even yet in some inconceivable way return to their normal. Absurd it undoubtedly was. But I had a very strong sense that the moment I stove in one of those sheets of plate glass, I should leave the old order behind me forever. I should become a looter, a sacker, a low scavenger upon the dead body of the system that had nourished me. Such a foolish niceness of sensibility in a stricken world. And yet it still pleases me to remember that civilized usage did not slide off me at once, and that for a time at least I wandered along past displays which made my mouth water while my already obsolete conventions kept me hungry. The problem resolved itself in a sophistical way after perhaps half a mile. A taxi, after mounting the pavement, had finished up with its radiator buried in a pile of delicatessen. That made it seem different from doing my own breaking in. I climbed past the taxi and collected the makings of a good meal. But even then, something of the old standard still clung. I conscientiously left a fair price for what I had taken lying on the counter. Almost across the road there was a garden. It was the kind that had once been the graveyard of a vanished church. The old headstones had been taken up and set back against the surrounding brick wall, the clear space turfed over, and laid out with graveled paths. It looked pleasant under the freshly leafed trees, and to one of the seats there I took my lunch. The place was withdrawn and peaceful. No one else came in, though occasionally a figure would shuffle past the railings at the entrance. I threw some crumbs to a few sparrows, the first birds I had seen that day, and felt all the better for watching their perky indifference to calamity. When I had finished eating, I lit a cigarette. While I sat there smoking it, wondering where I should go and what I should do, the quiet was broken by the sound of a piano played somewhere in a block of apartments that overlooked the garden. Presently a girl's voice began to sing. The song was Byron's ballad. So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving, and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon. I listened, looking up at the pattern that the tender young leaves and the branches made against the fresh blue sky. The song finished. The notes of the piano died away. Then there was a sound of sobbing. No passion. Softly, helplessly, forlorn, heartbroken. Who she was, whether it was the singer or another weeping her hopes away, I do not know. But to listen longer was more than I could endure. I went quietly back into the street, seeing it only mistily for a while. Even Hyde Park Corner, when I reached it, was almost deserted. A few derelict cars and lorries stood about on the roads. Very little, it seemed, had gone out of control when it was in motion. One bus had run across the path and come to rest in the Green Park. A runaway horse with shafts still attached to it lay beside the artillery memorial against which it had cracked its skull. The only moving things were a few men, and a lesser number of women feeling their way carefully with hands and feet where there were railings, unchecktively outstretched arms where there were not. Also, and rather unexpectedly, there were one or two cats, apparently intact visually, and treating the whole situation with that self-possession common to cats. They had poor luck prowling through the eerie quietness. The sparrows were few, and the pigeons had vanished. Still magnetically drawn towards the old centre of things, I crossed in the direction of Piccadilly. I was just about to start along it when I noticed a sharp new sound, a steady tapping not far away, and coming closer. Looking up Park Lane, I discovered its source. A man, more neatly dressed than any other I had seen that morning, was walking rapidly towards me, hitting the wall beside him with a white stick. As he caught the sound of my steps, he stopped, listening alertly. "It's all right," I told him. "Come on." I felt relieved to see him. He was, so to speak, normally blind. His dark glasses were much less disturbing than the staring but useless eyes of the others.
"Stand still, then," he said. "I've already been bumped into by God knows how many fools today. What the devil happened? Why is it so quiet? I know it isn't night. I can feel the sunlight. What's gone wrong with everything?"
I told him as much as I knew. When I had finished, he said nothing for almost a minute. Then he gave a short, bitter laugh.
"There's one thing," he said. "They'll be needing all their damn patronage for themselves now."
With that, he straightened up, a little defiantly.
"Thank you. Good luck," he said to me,
and set off westwards wearing an exaggerated air of independence. The sound of his briskly confident tapping gradually died away behind me as I made my way up Piccadilly. There were more people to be seen now, and I walked among the scatter of stranded vehicles in the road. Out there I was much less disturbing to the people feeling their way along the fronts of the buildings, for every time they heard a step close by they would stop and brace themselves against a possible collision. Such collisions were taking place every now and then all down the street, but there was one that I found significant. The subjects of it had been groping along a shopfront from opposite directions until they met with a bump. One was a young man in a well-cut suit, but wearing a tie obviously selected by touch alone. the other a woman who carried a small child. The child whined something inaudible. The young man had started to edge his way past the woman. He stopped abruptly.
"Wait a minute," he said. "Can your child see?"
"Yes," she said, "but I can't." The young man turned. He put one finger on the plate glass window, pointing.
"Look, Sonny, what's in there?"
he asked.
"Not Sonny,"
the child objected.
"Go on, Mary, tell the gentleman,"
her mother encouraged her.
"Pretty ladies,"
said the child. The man took the woman by the arm and felt his way to the next window.
"And what's in here?"
he asked again.
"Apples and things,"
the child told him.
"Fine,"
said the young man. He pulled off his shoe and hit the window a smart smack with the heel of it. He was inexperienced. The first blow did not do it, but the second did. The crash reverberated up and down the street. He restored his shoe, put an arm cautiously through the broken window, and felt about until he found a couple of oranges. One he gave to the woman, and one to the child. He felt about again, found one for himself, and began to peel it. The woman fingered hers.
"But," she began. "What's the matter? Don't like oranges?"
he asked.
"But it isn't right," she said. "We didn't ought to take 'em, not like this."
"How else are you going to get food?" he inquired.
"I suppose... well, I don't know,"
she admitted doubtfully.
"Very well, that's the answer. Eat it up now and we'll go and find something more substantial."
She still held the orange in her hand, head bent down as though she were looking at it.
"All the same, don't seem right,"
she said again, but there was less conviction in her tone. Presently she put the child down and began to peel the orange. Piccadilly Circus was the most populous place I had found so far. It seemed crowded after the rest, though there were probably less than 100 people there, all told. Mostly they were wearing queer, ill-assorted clothes, and were prowling restlessly around as though still semi-dazed. Occasionally a mishap would bring an outburst of profanity and futile rage, rather alarming to hear because it was itself the product of fright and childish intemper. But with one exception, there was little talk and little noise. It seemed as though their blindness had shut people into themselves. The exception had found himself a position out on one of the traffic islands. He was a tall, elderly, gaunt man with a bush of wiry grey hair, and he was holding forth emphatically about repentance, the wrath to come, and the uncomfortable prospects for sinners. Nobody was paying him any attention. For most of them, the day of wrath had already arrived. Then, from a distance, came a sound which caught everyone's attention, a gradually swelling chorus. "And when I die, don't bury me at all, just pickle my bones in alcohol." Dreary and untuneful, it slurred through the empty streets, echoing dismally back and forth. Every head in the circus was turning now left, now right, trying to place its direction. The prophet of doom raised his voice against the competition. The song wailed discordantly closer. "Put a bottle of booze at my head and my feet, and then, I'm sure, my bones will keep." And as an accompaniment to it, there was the shuffle of feet more or less in step. From where I stood, I could see them come in single file out of a side street into Shaftesbury Avenue and turn towards the circus. The second man had his hands on the shoulders of the leader, the third on his, and so on to the number of 25 or 30. At the conclusion of that song, somebody started "Beer, beer, glorious beer," pitching it in such a high key that it petered out in confusion. They trudged steadily on until they reached the centre of the circus. Then the leader raised his voice. It was a considerable voice, with parade ground quality.
"Comedy! Ho!"
Everybody else in the circus was now struck motionless, all with their faces turned towards him, all trying to guess what was afoot. The leader raised his voice again, mimicking the manner of a professional guide.
"Here we are, gents one and all, pick up Bloody Dilly Circus, the centre of the world, the hub of the universe, where all the knobs had their wine, women and song."
He was not blind. Far from it. His eyes were ranging round, taking stock as he spoke. His sight must have been saved by some such accident as mine. but he was pretty drunk, and so were the men behind him.
"And we'll have it too," he added. "Next stop, the well-known Café Royal, and all drinks on the house."
"Yes, but what about the women?"
asked a voice, and there was a laugh.
"Oh, women, is that what you want?" said the leader.
He stepped forward and caught a girl by the arm. She screamed as he dragged her towards the man who had spoken, but he took no notice of that.
"There you are, chump, and don't say I don't treat you right. It's a peach, a smasher, if that makes any difference to you."
"Then what about me?"
said the next man.
"You, mate. What is he? Like I'm blonde or dark."
Considered later, I suppose I behaved like a fool. My head was still full of standards and conventions that had ceased to apply. It did not occur to me that if there was to be any survive, anyone adopted by this gang would stand a far better chance than she would on her own. Fired with a mixture of schoolboy heroics and noble sentiments, I waded in. He didn't see me coming until I was quite close, and then I slogged for his jaw. Unfortunately, he was a little quicker. When I next took an interest in things, I found myself lying in the road. The sound of the gang was diminishing into the distance, and the prophet of doom, restored to eloquence, was sending threatful bolts of damnation, hellfire, and a brimstone gehenna hurtling after them. With a bit of sense knocked into me, I became thankful that the affair had not fallen out worse. Had the result been reversed, I could scarcely have escaped making myself responsible for the men he had been leading. After all, and whatever one might feel about his methods, he was the eyes of that party, and they'd be looking to him for food as well as for drink. And the women would go along too, on their own account as soon as they got hungry enough. And now I came to look around me, I felt doubtful whether any of the women hereabouts would seriously mind anyway. What with one thing and another, it looked as if I might have had a lucky escape from promotion to gang leadership. Remembering that they had been headed for the Café Royal, I decided to revive myself and clear my head at the Regent Palace Hotel. Others appeared to have thought of that before me, but there were quite a lot of bottles they had not found. I think it was while I was sitting there comfortably with a brandy in front of me and a cigarette in my hand that I at last began to admit that what I had seen was all real and decisive. There would be no going back, ever. It was finish to all I had known. Perhaps it had needed that blow to drive it home. Now I came face to face with the fact that my existence simply had no focus any longer. My way of life, my plans, ambitions, every expectation I had had, they were all wiped out at a stroke, along with the conditions that had formed them. I suppose that had I had any relatives or close attachments to mourn, I should have felt suicidally derelict at that moment. But what had seemed at times a rather empty existence turned out now to be lucky. My mother and father were dead. My one attempt to marry had miscarried some years before, and there was no particular person dependent on me. And, curiously, what I found that I did feel, with a consciousness that it was against what I ought to be feeling, was release. It wasn't just the brandy, for it persisted. I think it may have come from the sense of facing something quite fresh and new to me. All the old problems, the stale ones, both personal and general, had been solved by one mighty slash. Heaven alone knew as yet what others might arise, and it looked as though there would be plenty of them. But they would be new. I was emerging as my own master, and no longer a cog. It might well be a world full of horrors and dangers that I should have to face, but I could take my own steps to deal with it. I would no longer be shoved hither and thither by forces and interests that I neither understood nor cared about. No, it wasn't altogether the brandy. For even now, years afterwards, I can still feel something of it, though possibly the brandy did oversimplify things a little just then. Then there was, too, the little question of what to do next, how and where to start on this new life. But I did not let that worry me a lot for the present. I drank up and went out of the hotel to see what this strange world had to offer. Chapter 4. Shadows Before. In order to give a reasonable berth to the Café Royal mob, I struck up a side street into Soho, intending to cut back to Regent Street higher up. Perhaps hunger was driving more people out of their homes. Whatever the reason, I found that the parts I now entered were more populous than any I'd seen since I left the hospital. Constant collisions took place on the pavements and in the narrow streets, and the confusion of those who were trying to get along was made worse by knots of people clustering in front of the now frequently broken shop windows. None of those who crowded there seemed to be quite sure what kind of shop they were facing. Some in the front sought to find out by groping for any recognizable objects, others, taking the risk of disemboweling themselves on standing splinters of glass, more enterprisingly climbed inside. I felt that I ought to be showing these people where to find food. But should I? If I were to lead them to a food shop still intact, there would be a crowd which would not only have swept the place bare in 5 minutes, but have crushed a number of its weaker members in the process. Soon, anyway, all the food would be gone. Then what was to be done with the thousands clamoring for more? One might collect a small party and keep it alive somehow for an uncertain length of time. But who was to be taken? And who left? No obviously right course presented itself, however I tried to look at it. What was going on was a grim business without chivalry, with no give and all take about it. A man bumping into another and feeling that he carried a parcel would snatch it and duck away on the chance that it contained something to eat, while the loser clutched furiously at the air, or hit out indiscriminately. Once I had to step hurriedly aside to avoid being knocked down by an elderly man who darted into the roadway with no care for possible obstacles. His expression was vastly cunning, and he clutched avariciously to his chest 2 cans of red paint. On a corner, my way was blocked by a group almost weeping with frustration over a bewildered child who could see, but was just too young to understand what they wanted of it. I began to become uneasy. Fighting with my civilized urge to be of some help to these people was an instinct that told me to keep clear. They were already fast losing ordinary restraints. I felt, too, an irrational sense of guilt at being able to see while they could not. It gave me an odd feeling that I was hiding from them even while I moved among them. Later on, I found how right the instinct was. Close to Golden Square, I began to think of turning left and working back to Regent Street, where the wider roadway would offer easier going. I was about to take a corner that would lead me that way when a sudden piercing scream stopped me. It stopped everyone else, too. All along the street they stood still, turning their heads this way and that, apprehensively trying to guess what was happening. The alarm coming on top of their distress and nervous tension started a number of the women whimpering. The men's nerves weren't in any too good a state either. They showed it mostly in short curses at being startled. For it was an ominous sound, one of the kind of things they had been subconsciously expecting. They waited for it to come again. It did, frightened, and dying into a gasp, but less alarming now that one was ready for it. This time I was able to place it. A few steps took me to an alley entrance. As I turned the corner, a cry that was half a gasp came again. The cause of it was a few yards down the alley. A girl was crouched on the ground while a burly man laid into her with a thin brass rod. The back of her dress was torn, and the flesh beneath showed red weals. As I came closer, I saw why she did not run away. Her hands were tied together behind her back, and a cord tethered them to the man's left wrist. I reached the pair as his arm was raised for another stroke. It was easy to snatch the rod from his unexpecting hand and bring it down with some force upon his shoulder. He promptly lashed a heavy boot out in my direction, but I had dodged back quickly, and his radius of action was limited by the cord on his wrist. He made another swiping kick at the air while I was feeling in my pocket for a knife. Finding nothing there, he turned and kicked the girl for good measure instead. Then he swore at her and pulled on the cord to bring her to her feet. I slapped him on the side of his head, just hard enough to stop him and make it sing for a bit. Somehow I could not bring myself to lay out a blind man, even this type. While he was steadying himself from that, I stooped swiftly and cut the cord which joined them. A slight shove on his chest sent him staggering back, and half turned him so that he lost his bearings. With his freed left hand, he let out a fine raking swing. It missed me, but ultimately reached the brick wall. After that, he lost interest in pretty well everything but the pain of his cracked knuckles. I helped the girl up, loosed her hands, and led her away down the alley while he was still blistering the air behind us. As we turned into the street, she began to come up out of her daze. She turned a smeary, tear-stained face and looked up at me.
"But you can see," she said, incredulously.
"Certainly I can," I told her.
"Oh, thank God. Thank God, I thought I was the only one," she said,
and burst into tears again. I looked around us. A few yards away there was a pub with a gramophone playing, glasses smashing and a high old time being had by all. A few yards beyond that was a smaller pub, still intact. A good heave with my shoulder broke in the door to the saloon bar. I half carried the girl in and put her in a chair. Then I dismembered another chair and put two of its legs through the handles of the swing doors for the discouragement of further visitors before I turned my attention to the restoratives at the bar. There was no hurry. She sipped at and snuffled over the first drink. I gave her time to get sorted out, twiddling the stem of my glass and listening to the gramophone in the other pub churning out the currently popular, if rather lugubrious, ditty. "My love's locked up in a frigid air and my heart's in a deep freeze pack. She's gone with a guy I'd not know where, but she wrote that she'd never come back. Now she don't care for me no more, I'm just a one-man frozen store, and it ain't nice to be on ice with my love locked up in a frigid air and my heart in a deep freeze pack." While I sat, I stole an occasional covert look at the girl. Her clothes, or the remnants of them, were good quality. Her voice was good, too. Probably not stage or movie acquired, for it had not deteriorated under stress. She was blonde, but quite a number of shades sub-platinum. It seemed likely that beneath the smudges and smears she was good-looking. Her height was 3 or 4 inches less than mine, her build slim, but not thin. She looked as if she had strength, if it were necessary, but strength which, in her approximately 24 years, had most likely not been applied to anything more important than hitting balls, dancing, and probably restraining horses. Her well-shaped hands were smooth, and the fingernails that were still unbroken showed a length more decorative than practical. End of Disc 2.